Okay, if you remember, we got to looking at the obstacle of personal biases, you know, what a huge kind of part they play in how we react to that kind of fundamental ignorance in us that has us mistaking appearances for reality. And thinking, well, how do you, if you could sidestep them, that would be a step in the direction of not mistaking appearances for reality. And so then not being subject to this almost mechanical or hypnotic clinging, liking and disliking, attachments and aversions and so on and so forth. And see it for what it is. And in seeing it for what it is, remembering that there's nothing wrong with that. If you can see it for what it is, then if you prefer coffee to tea, it doesn't matter. But if you think one is inherently awful and the other one inherently divine, then it's problematic. Does it kind of make sense with a trivial example? It might be a good idea not to be worrying about how you maintain your preferences. Yes, I want to maintain my preferences. That's more important to me. Fear of losing that is telling me something, no? I don't want to lose that. I want to make... Actually, if you go the other way and think if you want not to be driven mechanically, not driven by mistaking something for existing in a way that it doesn't, appearances from reality, however you want to put it, it's not going to do anything... You're still in a position to choose. In fact, you might have even more choice. You still might prefer one thing over another. Yeah. A lot of it's about a balance sensitivity. I mean, I might go to the cupboard and find that I might be fancying Earl Grey tea. Then I go to the cupboard and I find there isn't any Earl Grey tea there. And if I kind of say, oh, well... I kind of, you know, I would have liked some Earl Grey tea, but I'll have something else. Well, it doesn't really matter. Because there isn't any there, that's the fact of the matter, then there's not a problem. But if I go there and find out that it isn't there, and then go through the roof, and can't bear the idea that there's no Earl Grey tea, and it all gets terribly unbalanced, then I've got a problem.
All right.
You know, if I go then storming to the management and say, why isn't there any Earl Grey tea? You know? It's kind of, you think, hang on, it's got a bit. Yeah. And that's because I kind of think that it's not so much about the tea on that occasion. It's, I think what has arisen in me, the sense of I, me and mine, inherently exists when it doesn't. So on that basis, I misperceive it, make something of it. I'm missing this. I'm outraged. Why haven't they considered me? I can't get what I want. I can't get through another day without Earl Grey tea. See? It's like that. No?
Yeah, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So
we know our preferences are healthy in some way when we can do without them in a way as well. Like, we're not bound to them as such.
No, because I think, you think if you think about it from an ordinary psychological point of view, obsessions and compulsions are really just desires that are out of control. So there's that kind of balance. More importantly, I think from the getting back to the fundamental one, because this is coming to the point where we're coming to next in the sequence in there. But more importantly, it's... whether you choose the tea or the chocolate, yeah, there is the thing about you said, well, you didn't make a consideration about whether it was a healthy choice, which, you know, can in a balanced conventional way be quite a sensible thing to do. If you're interested in health, you might not be that bothered. I might decide that the difference between tea and chocolate is such a low impact on my health, I'm not worried. But if I was very hypersensitive or had a dairy allergy or something like that, then I might take a very kind of different view. But the important thing is, did whichever you reach for, And let's say you went for the chocolate. Did the tin, the chocolate, and that seem to be existing from its own side? Did it have its own pull? Did it have its own attraction? Did your desire for it appear to be sort of appearing from its own side, existing from its own side? I have an inherently existent desire for chocolate, rather than something that arose, because maybe if I hadn't have declared a break, you'd still be sitting here not thinking about going out there and not worrying about whether it was tea or chocolate. So that kind of arose in dependence on there being a break, thinking about whether you wanted refreshment, if so, what did you want? And then all the manifold and complex reasons as to why one might choose chocolate over tea. That's arising, coming up, going down according to conditions. But we lock onto it. We lock onto ourselves, our desire for it or aversion to it, and the thing itself, all as having some sort of independent existence from its own side that appears to be more concrete and solid than it actually is. Like that. So first of all, it's kind of recognizing that, being aware of it. Mm. I mean, it sounds somehow not right, but in order to catch the process, in order to become aware of it, you almost have to decide not to do anything about it for a while. Carry on as normal, yeah? And see if you can be present to what's happening. The more you're present to whatever it is, the more it kind of throws into high relief and the more you see the process of it. Don't be too eager to want to change anything at first. Just see if you can get a clear idea of what's going on. And it can take, there's no particular time, but it can take some of us longer than others and some of us longer with some things than with others and so on and so forth. Depends on too many factors. So first of all, it's just gently exploring. Oh, there's appearance and reality. We have a tendency to mistake appearances for reality. If we didn't do that, then there might be the possibility of cutting off this slavish craving and development of unhelpful attractions and aversions and being liberated from that, being driven by something else that might be almost unconscious or as a result of some past actions, be they extremely pleasant or traumatic or whatever it was, some sort of past experience. You're not forgetting there's a survival value in not putting your finger in the flame, but there's lots of other things where it's not about that, but we react in the same way as if it is like that. Now, if I'm running in fear from making a decision to go into fright or flight over a tiger, out there, out in its native circumstances, then it's a good decision to make and make the right one. Yeah. But if I get like that over a house spider, there's a problem. What's happened? It's like, oh, there's trauma. I don't like them, but they don't bite. They're not poisonous. They can't kill me. They're more frightened of me than I am of them. I'm huge. They're small. They can't stand the smell of human beings, you know. But none of that is dependent on all those things. But for us, it exists from its own side. The ugliness or fear is almost built into it. There's something about it. I don't want to touch it. It's all in there, you know. But this, if you kind of think about it in this way, approach it in this way, you think, well, yeah, it looks like that. It's like the snake. You think the rope is a snake. All the feelings are there and all the stuff is there as if all this is coming from its own side. But in actual fact, it's what we're projecting into it. It's what we're projecting a fantasized mode of existence on it. Imagining it as existing in a way that it doesn't. The house spider becomes a tarantula. And a poisonous one at that, sort of. That's the issue. So when you get, so in, coming back to more mundane things, it's like, did the tin or the tea seem to be there, totally existing from its own side, completely, singular, permanent, partless, always there, kind of got some sort of existence from its own side, not dependent on anything, separate out here, you know, like the book. There it is. It's a book. We call it a book. It's sitting there. It's kind of completely independent on its own, existing from its own side. But as soon as I go to the very famous Thich Nhat Hanh analysis, there was a sea. And then the temperature changed and the sea started to evaporate. And then at a higher altitude, it condensed and became clouds. And then the clouds came across the land and they rained. And they rained and soaked into the earth. And there happened to be seeds from a tree last year. And they grow and they sprouted and came up. And that multiplied a thousandfold. And then people came along and cut the trees down. And deciding what to do with the trees, they, well, we need some paper. So they turn it, by all the processes with which we're roughly familiar, into paper. And then someone has an idea about, I want to write a book, and a publisher gets it together and they hook up with a printer and it gets printed. And here it is, I bought one, I'm reading it, I'm using it. But of course, it's already looking a bit tatty. It's really much looser and easier to open than when I first bought it. And the pages are a bit faded. And we know where it's going to go, don't we? We know that it's going to get to a point where even if I unsell it or give it away, it'll end up in a second-hand bookshop and then it'll be falling to pieces. And if someone is sort of like a Buddhist and treats it as very respectful, then they'll take it away and want to put it in the air, or they'll burn it in a fire. Or maybe the pages will just get distributed everywhere, end up in landfill, do all sorts of things. But what's going to happen in the end is it's all going to break down into its constituents. Yeah. And then it's going to drain away and probably find itself in the sea. And then the sea will evaporate. So at what point is it an independently existing from its own side? Completely permanent, partless thing. Yeah. It's something that arises as a result of causes and conditions, appears because of it, but we're not very often just blind to, or we're not kind of aware of it, of the history of all of that, and all the people that put it together and so on and so forth, and the fact that it's a constantly moving, dynamic process. So we lock into the, you know, the relative stability of it, thinking, it's permanent. It's not. The reason Scottish mountains are nowhere near the size of the Himalayas is because they're older. Only we look at mountains as a fine example of solidity, but of course they're moving, changing, eroding, avalanching, bits falling off them. They're doing this all the time. And so although there's different scales, you know, of it, that nothing lasts. Nothing's permanent. So for that reason alone, how could there ever be a singular, permanent, partless, not dependent on anything existing from its own side kind of thing? It's either a part of the whole shooting match or it's not. How do we get to a point where we say, oh, you know, we're going to examine nature or do this with nature, or, you know, we're in some kind of battle with nature when we're a part of it. You know, you understand, you say, well, I want to investigate metal or matter or whatever it is, but somehow thinking that nature's over there and we're here is bizarre. Fantasized way of existing again. So that's the one, more than the preferences. How does the tin, the tea, the objects, the colours and everything else actually appear? Then you, if you come back to the into the, if you like, the subjective side of this, look at it from a subjective point of view. As I say, something, you know, I want chocolate or I want tea. When that one comes up, we don't think, oh, it's that that collection of perceptions, internal feelings, and mental idea have just popped up in dependence on all sorts of other things, we tend to regard it as if there is something in there that is continuous, that has all these ideas and preferences and views of the world. That there's some, that there's something solidly existing in there in a way that it doesn't. It's not to say that we don't exist. Of course we do. Here we all are. But the contention here is we don't exist in the way we think we do, in the way we normally assume we do. We assume that it's like that, that I'm something behind my eyes. That somehow if you... there might be some way of getting Roy out, or Roy's essence out. Well, you're saying you've got no soul. Well, no, not in that sense. But then soul doesn't mean that for me. My soul is about feeling. My soul is about all sorts of things. But it's not something you can take out. Can I really... we're a long way past Descartes. Can we really separate? Well, is there anybody left that really thinks there's any credibility in mind being separate from matter? Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form's not other than emptiness. It's, that's kind of saying almost at a universal level that body and consciousness of the universe are one and the same, two different manifestations of the same thing. Yeah, if it's just mechanical and out of conditioning, then that's just going to generate more of the same. And if unchecked, the desires or aversions get out of control, they become obsessions, compulsions, and lead us into all sorts of problems and difficulties. Yeah? As well as limiting us, they reinforce and make more concrete the inherent existence that we think we have, and then limit our possibilities for really developing our full potential and being free from being driven by habit and conditioning.
That makes sense.
A bit like that. So it leads really well into where I was going, or where in terms of His Holiness's structure. Because if you're trying to then sidestep those personal biases, those, you know, the old friend, I, me and mine, you want to sidestep that to have a better kind of experience of the world in a more interdependent, intersubjective light, then you might think, oh, well, maybe I should just withdraw myself from stuff that makes a problem, you know, whether that's I'm very attached to it or I'm very averse to it, whether it's a strong desire or a strong really I don't want it, or I really like that person and I really hate that person. Maybe I should just withdraw from all of that as much as possible. Yeah, I suppose in a way, if it's very, very strong, then it might be helpful, you know, but it's a temporary patch. You know, if it's got to the point where I just like somebody so much I might hit them, it might be a good idea if I kind of just put it down from and try and sort of, no, I'm not going there. So that can be sort of tactically effective. But strategically, and a lot of that might be out of fear, mightn't it? Might be because I'm not really thinking, oh, I don't want to hurt them, or I might be mistaking appearances from reality. I'm thinking, I don't want to be charged for assault. I don't want to go to prison. Or I think they're much bigger than me and I'm not going to win. Or whatever it is, you know, I'm driven by all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so it's kind of like that. So, and similarly, with stuff that we might be very attracted to, I suppose, if a desire is out of control and it's going to become an obsession or an addiction, then maybe to consider removing yourself from circumstances where the immediate temptation is there. You know, if you're, it's probably one of the first things. I don't know if anybody's involved in any kind of addiction therapy or whatever else, but very often the person is stable. Is it possible for the person to take themselves out of the social circle they're in, go somewhere else to, or not go to the same places, not at the same times, and to stop doing this? And that may create a bit of time and a bit of space to do something. But if something else isn't done, it's just going to happen again and again and again. What, when that space is there, the withdrawal, you know, might be temporarily useful, but it's a sticking plaster. So the same here, the idea that just by withdrawing the mind from disturbing objects, trying to get away or escape from attachment and aversion, is going to make some difference. Well, in the long term, it's not. And it's also still a psychology itself based on attraction and aversion. I want to do this rather than that, and this, you know, and all of that. So you're going around in this in similar sorts of circles. But the idea here, the rather radical proposition here, is that if you realise that the objects of desire, if you like, and aversion, don't exist in the way that we assume they do when we mistake appearances for reality, then those attachments and aversions will not arise, because you'll see them for what they are and they won't have any magnetic power or pull. Yeah, and in doing that, that doesn't mean you still won't or might not want to choose between chocolate and tea. That's fine, you know, we're alive. So if we can realise that things don't exist in and of themselves as they appear, independent of mind, which, remember, that's one of the things we were looking at, what's our contribution to all this, then even if they, looking at it this way, and I'm cutting back to that level of seeing things, at the moment, you know, everything around me looks as if it's completely separate, independent, and exists from its own side. But I've got some sort of idea that they don't really. How? The same way that I analyse the book. There's a kind of a knowledge. I'm thinking, well, okay, I can tell the story of the book, but I don't have to tell the story of the book to myself every time. I kind of know. Even though it appears like that, it's not like that. So that's the idea here, that if we can realise that things don't exist in and of themselves as they appear, independent of the mind, then even if they continue out of habit to appear that way, we can know that they don't. And that insight is the way out. It's kind of knowing it, but again, it's back. It's not so much rejecting as seeing it for what it is. Because you pick on a really good example in that, and it's a subject I do know something about. You know, I won't put a value judgment on it. But people engaged in advertising and marketing, they know the mechanics.
Yeah.
They know this as good as any Buddhist, probably better than most. They know how it works, but they use it to make money.
Yeah.
And they're not bothered that you're going to be caught in a loop over it. No. In fact, the more and the longer, the better.
Worse me, yeah? Money all the time.
And if you... So, the way you deal with that, it's in the environment. You can't reject it. You know, it'd have to be some revolution that would blow them all up. And, you know, whatever. That's part of the environment in which we live. I suppose in its own strange way, that art, if you like, black art, whatever, if you want to put a value judgment on it, has been around since the beginning of time. You know, it's what selling is all about, isn't it? I make something I've got. I try to take what I've got to people who I know will want it, and then try to make it look as attractive as possible, if not more attractive than it actually is, to the point where they will not be able to resist picking it up and giving me the money. And advertising and marketing is just bigging that up. The very mechanics that we've been talking about is happening, all right? But and it will still appear that way to me, you know. If there's something I really like, or something that really gets me going, you know, and it appears on a poster on the tube wall or on some advert on the internet, I don't watch television anymore, or, you know, whatever happens, and all the buttons are pushed, but I know what's going on, I can say, nah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, it's interesting. Stimulation. Or aversion. Well, that's it. But nah. Thanks. Bye. It's still having that effect, but I'm not sucked in. I'm not believing it. It still appears as it appears, but I'm not hooked. You know, to go back to the fish and the bait, I don't like this with it. Oh, they're advertising it. Sometimes I can even admire it. You know, someone who knows a bit about that, so, oh, that's beautifully done. Not meaning it's beautiful in an aesthetic sense, although it might be. It's like that. It's mean, but it's clever. You know, it's perfectly executed. Yeah, I can see people, you know, queuing up outside X shop waiting for those. Or I can see people wanting to go and buy those clothes just because he or she looks so beautiful in them. You know, we all want to be attractive to those who we desire in that way. You know, click, 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 click. Or, you know, I haven't had a beer for ages. Whatever it is. Or, my car looks really tatty as compared to that one. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. What I'm saying, well, to get back to it, is that will not immediately change. But if you see it for what it is, if you see what's going on, then you're much less likely. In fact, if you know what's going on, you won't be likely at all to fall for it. You'll be aware of the power of it, but you won't fall for it. I mean, back to your question, I think they should, with that in a fun way, right at a really early age, teach children much more critical thinking. Because, mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll see it. You really want that lollipop, don't you? What's going on there then? You can have it. Do you want a bigger one? And you can play. You know, you can play with them in a way that they might say, "Here, I sort of kind of see what's going on." Yeah. And back, well, Lama Yeshe had a wonderful one on this subject, where somebody used the example of chocolate cake, and he was saying, "Well, chocolate cake's absolutely delightful." He said, "If you love chocolate cake, I love chocolate cake. I actually don't love chocolate cake, but he did." And he was saying, there's nothing wrong with the taste or the enjoyment of the chocolate cake. It's divine. It's lovely. But when you've got it, you've got it. And when you haven't, you haven't. And he'd say, do you have to eat the whole cake and then another one and another one and another one? Yeah, that's because we think the pleasure or the enjoyment is inherently existing in the cake. Yeah, it's a very kind of one-sided play. So the idea here is that apart from those common sense situations, it's not about the sticking plaster method of just kind of isolating ourselves from attachments and aversions, but actually trying to say, what can we do to realise, to have insight into the way it really is, and so that even if it continues to appear the way it is, you know that it doesn't really exist like that. Yeah. I mean, it's why it sounds extreme to some people, but if you look back into Buddhist meditative culture, then, you know, whether male or female, there are quite long and what we would regard as morbid meditations on the impermanence of the body. You know, and you think, oh, this person's really, really attractive. And then you think, okay, we'll cut them open. Or what are they going to look like when they're 90? Or what would they look like when they're dead? What's really inside them? Yeah. What are all these cosmetics doing? And so on and so forth. If you continually sort of look at it from that point of view, this is a little bit, it's a stronger medicine than the one we were doing about either talking up the advantages or talking down the disadvantage of the apparent object of desire. Well, if that's done, then suddenly it's not quite so attractive. And even if it goes back and the person looks very attractive, you have to face, which I think is a really good thing, the reality, well, people will get old. They will change. Attractiveness may not always be the same thing. Maybe the relationships I want aren't just based on that. Is that a good? Do you see what I mean? There's a way through. But if we're just driven by thinking it inherently exists the way it is, independent, existing from its own side, unchanging, permanent, there's going to be a car crash at some point, isn't there? It's like, it's not, oh, it's not like that. Oh, you mean you didn't know it was like that? Well, no, it seemed so attractive at the time. There's nothing to say that there's anything wrong with relationships or things being attractive or enjoyment or eating the chocolate cake. That's not the problem. Our attachment or our aversion to it is the problem. It's a kind of an attachment or an aversion that exceeds the kind of substantiality with which the thing actually exists. Anyway, that's the idea. So the idea is that insight will lead to... I'm all right at the moment. It's all right. I'm being a good boy. That's all right. Yeah, it's our insight into the nature of reality rather than mistaking kind of assenting to appearances existing the way they are that will be the liberator, that will free us from those kind of habits and conditionings that will lead us to make choices that will do nothing in the medium to long term but cause suffering, both to ourselves and others. That kind of makes sense. Anyway, any more questions? Because I reckon having a flat, recognizing that it's there, and doing what you need to do not to lose it or damage it, there's not a problem there, is there? That's just practical. That, and you're seeing it for what it is. But, for example, I right now don't own a property. I rent a property. I've no idea how much longer I might live. I might die tonight or tomorrow, so then it won't matter. But let's imagine that I live for another 10 or 12 years. If I just assume that the flat, because I'm renting it, will always be there, and then there's 1,000 things that arise that mean that the landlord says, I want you out by the end of the month, or in my case, 3 months, or whatever it is, you know what I mean? And then I'll be shocked. Then I've mistaken appearances for reality. That anger that's arising and all of that is because I'm attached to something that I thought existed in a certain way that actually doesn't. It wouldn't have taken me much to go and look at the contract and just think about the relationships and everything involved, and then think about the uncertainties of the world and the fact that I'm not the only person living in it, and the person that rents it to me has responsibilities and so on. So I live on a chance. People say, "Oh, why did?" Well, yeah, I did buy it, then I sold at the wrong time, and never bought another one. So I negotiate my life like this, and there's not a problem with that. And someone might say, "Well, you really don't want to lose where you live, do you?" And I say, "Well, no, I don't." But whereas if I just, no possibility, you can't get me out. I'm never going to go, and it's really terrible, and my life's going to dissolve, and I can't exist. Where's that going? There's attachment. Do you see what I mean? There's attachment.
Yeah.
Yes, there's no problem with that. This is not saying you can't do that. It's saying see it for what it is. Don't mistake the appearance of it for reality. Yeah. I mean, in relationships, but putting it bluntly, I suppose I'm long enough in the tooth to say it. How long ago did I get over the idea, oh, I'm in love, it's going to last forever, it's never going to change? Oh, well, I laugh at my former self. What happened? I stopped mistaking appearances for reality. I stopped thinking there was an inherently existing me loving an inherently existing person with an inherently existing love that was never going to end, or change. I mean, how realistic was that? It's a fantasized way of existing. Does that mean I've not subsequently been able to have really, really happy, ecstatic and loving relationships? No. It's just a different perspective, a different way of looking at it. Recognition that however it appears, it doesn't really exist in that way. Does that mean it doesn't exist? No, it exists in another way. And if you can see it for what it is, of course you can make rational choices, plan, have preferences, enjoy it. With that, I'd probably want to argue you can enjoy life to the full. Free. Liberated from previous kind of fixed and over-concretized elements in our psychology that actually prevent our development. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency then for it all to get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller instead of wider and wider and wider. But does that mean then that, you know, we are desireless robots? No, of course not. But to, you know, what I'm suggesting is it might enable us to embrace life in a far healthier, far more engaging and beautiful way than was previously possible. There is this kind of, I suppose it's the language involved. There are lots of people who don't go very far into Buddhist philosophy. You think, well, God, it's the end of desire. You know, it's like not doing anything and quietism and withdraw and detach from life. No, it's saying, see things as they actually are, as opposed to mistaking their appearances for reality. Mm-hmm. And then the problematic attachments and aversions will dissolve. They won't have the power that they formerly have. And you'll be liberated from psychic existence, doing the same thing over and over again, largely a result of unconscious, previously existing choices and actions. No? That makes sense? Like that. It's five. So, let's have a break to 5:15.